The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Public Radio News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us this hour for our monthly check-in on the nation's top political stories. In the presidential primary campaign, Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders continues to draw large crowds, including in the Granite State. At a middle school in Conway, Sanders disparaged how the press has covered this year's campaigns.
Increasingly, what media sees campaigns being are soap operas and football games, rather than a serious discussion about the serious issues facing America.
Meanwhile, the 17 GOP candidates also continue to make the rounds in New Hampshire. Republican Ted Cruz addressed a crowd at a New Boston town hall meeting on Sunday, calling out other Republicans for what he sees as their weakness on social issues.
If you say you support marriage, what did you do when the Supreme Court issued a fundamentally illegitimate, unconstitutional, and lawless decision? If you say you support life, what are you doing right now to urge congressional leadership? No show votes, no empty votes. Actually defund Planned Parenthood now.
And ahead of a visit to Alaska to address climate change, President Obama officially returned the country's biggest mountain back to its native name, Denali. Republican U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska praised the move.
I'd like to thank the president for working with us to achieve this significant change to show honor, respect, and gratitude to the Athabascan people of Alaska.
This hour on The Exchange, political junkie Ken Rudin is back for a monthly look at the top political news of the nation. And let's hear from you. Your questions and comments for Ken are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken Rudin, welcome back. Great to have you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, before we dive into the substance of our show, trivia question, please.
The trivia question is, well, you know, we keep focusing on polls. I keep telling people that we shouldn't pay attention to polls, but every time there's a new poll, we all get very excited. And so there's a poll that shows Bernie Sanders closing in on Hillary Clinton in Iowa. And we've seen New Hampshire polls that show Bernie Sanders with the lead, but most people think that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee. So my trivia question is, who's the first person who failed to win in Iowa and New Hampshire and yet went on to win the presidency?
Okay, so just to repeat, Exchange listeners, if you think you know the answer, who was the first person who failed to win in Iowa and New Hampshire and nonetheless went on to win the presidency? If you think you know the answer, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. See if you know the answer to this month's trivia question. Well, Ken, where to start with the presidential campaigns? I hate to do this since we're New Hampshire Public Radio, but let's start with that other early nomination state, Iowa, because there was a lot of activity there recently. How's the Republican dynamic shaking out in the Hawkeye State, Ken?
Well, who knows? And the reason I say who knows is because we watch this and we see the polls and we see the campaigners, and it's hard to really comprehend what's going on. It's, you know, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. The establishment candidates in both parties basically are certainly having their headaches. In the Republican Party, they're getting their heads handed to them, especially if you buy the argument, and many people bought the argument, that Jeb Bush was the anointed one. I mean, it was his turn. But, I mean, of course, we've seen Donald Trump in polls, and look at the numbers who show up at his rallies. Donald Trump seems to be hogging the headlines. Although I thought the interesting, one of the most interesting things, well, two things in the latest Iowa poll, the Des Moines Register poll. One, second place, close behind, was Ben Carson. Ben Carson, who, of course, has never run for office before, the former child neurosurgeon. I think Ben Carson is really missing out on something. I mean, remember during the last debate when he said that in his closing statement, he said he separated conjoined twins. And I feel that somebody running for president should bring people together, not pull them apart. So I think that's kind of strange. But anyway, so you have Donald Trump and Ben Carson, 1 and 2, with 41% of the vote. And that just shows that at least the Republicans at this point are so anti-politician, anti-establishment, and, you know, to quote the movie Network, mad as hell, that you have two people who are so anti-establishment in the top two positions.
Well, it's interesting, and that did catch my eye as well, Ken, that Ben Carson is pulling up with Donald Trump in Iowa anyway. Here is Ben Carson speaking at the Iowa State Fair in August, explaining why, though nearing the end of his esteemed career, as you mentioned, deciding to run for president.
We are in the process of destroying the future for the next generation. You know, I spent my whole professional career looking out for the welfare of children. And believe me, I was looking forward to retirement and putting my feet up. But I really couldn't, knowing what was going to happen to their future, if we continue down the same route.
Again, that's Ben Carson, Republican presidential candidate, speaking at the Iowa State Fair in mid-August. So what is Ben Carson tapping into, Ken? What do you think?
Well, I think part of it, he doesn't have the bombast of Donald Trump. Matter of fact, he's extremely soft-spoken. He's also very likable. He doesn't attack other fellow Republicans, unlike Donald Trump. He has just a very nice message about change, and he's an outsider. And I think, it's resonating, certainly, in both Iowa and New Hampshire. What surprises me is that, again, if you look at his past statements, I mean, recently he said the other day that homosexuality is a choice, that a lot of people, for example, they go into prison straight and they come out gay, so that must be a choice. And he said some things comparing the Affordable Care Act to slavery. He said a lot of unpolitic things in the past, but again, he's certainly real. He's not contrived. He says what's on his mind, and people just, like that approach.
Again, our number for you to join us as we talk with political junkie Ken Rudin is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Ken, I do want to ask you about another candidate that's doing well in Iowa, and that's Carly Fiorina. But first, we've got a couple people who think they know the answer to this month's trivia question. Again, who was the first candidate who failed to win in Iowa and New Hampshire and nonetheless went on to win the White House? And let's see if Geraldine in Salisbury knows. Hi, Geraldine. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Good morning, Laura. I'm relaying this from my father, whose guest was George Bush.
Which George Bush, by the way, Geraldine?
George W.
Okay. All right. Is she right, Ken?
Well, George W. Bush got his clock cleaned in 2000, losing to John McCain in New Hampshire, but he did win Iowa. So George W. Bush is not the correct answer.
Okay. So not the right answer, but thank you, Geraldine. Again, the question, who's the first person who failed to win in Iowa and New Hampshire and nonetheless went on to win the White House? If you think you know the answer, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to Tom in Manchester. Hi, Tom. You're on the exchange with Ken Rudin.
Hi, how are you? Is it Bill Clinton?
What do you think, Ken?
Bill Clinton is the correct answer.
That's interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
We got him on the second call. But yeah, in 1992... nobody competed in Iowa because Tom Harkin, the favorite son, was the candidate. So Bill Clinton and the other Democrats basically stayed out. And in New Hampshire, of course, Paul Tsongas beat Bill Clinton, although Bill Clinton liked to call himself the comeback kid, basically taking away the joy of Paul Tsongas' victory. But Bill Clinton is the correct answer.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. A lot of people think Bill Clinton won the New Hampshire primary that year. But you're right, Ken, he didn't.
That's correct. The comeback kid, and that stuck with him. That Monica, I can't say Monica, but I mean that nickname stuck with him for the longest time. And New Hampshire kind of pushed him away. Of course, he didn't win his first primary until Georgia weeks later. But again, that was the aberration. That's not basically you have to win one, if not both of them, to be move on to the nomination.
Well, so speaking again of Iowa, let's talk about Carly Fiorina. I hear she's doing pretty well down there, too, or out there, I should say.
She is, and I think part of it was that she got a very strong review from her from the kids' table debate in the Fox News debate in Cleveland a couple of weeks ago, three, 4 weeks ago. She seemed to dominate the – this, of course, was not the top 10 candidate debate. It was the earlier bottom seven candidate, but she topped the field because she not only took on Donald Trump, she took on Hillary Clinton, and her argument, of course, is that there's no way they can attack me as part of the Republican war on women because I happen to be a woman. So there's no way you can attack. And she's, you know, she reminds me, I hate to use the word attack dog, but you always think of like Richard Nixon in 1952 and Bob Dole in 76, Agnew in 68, those kind of Republicans who were on the ticket as the vice presidential running mate and went on to just attack the Democrats over and over and over. She is doing that role, and she's doing it effectively because she does it with a smile.
Well, and there's an upcoming debate, and there's been this question about, you know, who's going to make it to this second debate. Here's Carly Fiorina on the Fox News show On the Record talking about the next debate and CNN's criteria, that's who's sponsoring it, for selecting who gets to participate.
Well, you know, I'm in the top five in every statewide poll. Actually, we do have state primaries, not national primaries, and I'm also comfortably in the top 10 in every national poll. So maybe them using all these polls from before August 6th is a little bit like keeping a football team out of the playoffs because of a preseason game.
Again, that's former Hewlett-Packard CEO and Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina speaking on Fox News. And CNN did change the criteria, Ken, for who can...
That's exactly right. I mean, originally, Fox News was going to say that they were going to take the sum of all the polls, including prior to the August debate, to decide who goes into the September 16th Republican debate in California. But now they changed yesterday. They changed their mind. They're going to only look at polls since the first debate. And of course, that's very good news for Carly Fiorina because she is in some polls, she's in double digits in Iowa. And in many polls, she's in the top five, let alone the top 10. So my guess is that she does make the September 16th debate, the CNN debate.
Okay. So who doesn't? Do we know who gets bumped off?
Well, no. I mean, there are a lot of people, I don't know about a lot, but there are some candidates who are just not doing well. I mean, Rand Paul seems to be invisible since then. Chris Christie is not showing much strength. But who knows what's going to happen? I mean, everybody's talking about John Kasich, how well he's doing in New Hampshire. And the latest Iowa poll had him with 2%. So you know, I
wow,
mean,
big differences
who knows what's
going
to happen.
All right, Ken, I got to wrap you up there for just a moment. More in just a minute. This is The Exchange.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR is sustaining members support NHPR the same way they listen to it all year long. Sustainers break up their payment into manageable monthly gifts directly from their bank account. You can find out more about sustaining membership at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Groponi Automotive Group, providing six auto lines, including Ford, Toyota, and Honda, in a relaxing, stress-free sales environment. Driven to amaze and bow and online at groponi.com. And University of New Hampshire at Manchester, now offering a Bachelor of Science degree in analytics. Information at manchester.unh.edu/analytics. Hazy, hot and humid today. High temperatures mid-80s to around 90 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight. Areas of fog in the overnight. Lows from upper 50s north, ranging upper 60s in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our monthly check-in with political junkie Ken Rudin. Once a month, Ken joins us to review some of the top political stories of the nation. We've been talking about some of the activity in the Republican presidential primary, and in a few minutes, we'll turn our attention to the Democrats. You can join us, too, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So just a couple more questions for you on the Republicans, and then we should talk about the Democrats because there's been some activity there as well. You talked about who might appear on that CNN stage in 2 weeks, Ken, and who might not. Other candidates who've been staking out positions recently.
Yes, and I think the most interesting of the bunch is Scott Walker. And the reason I say Scott Walker is once upon a time, and once upon a time means 3-4 months ago, but once upon a time, he was the so-called front runner in Iowa. He's from nearby Wisconsin. He spent a lot of time there in Iowa at a conservative forum last January. Scott Walker really knocked over everybody, including the national media, with a very effective presentation. But he certainly, like many Republicans, he's been eclipsed by Donald Trump, and he also seems to be trying to move his positions to put him in the same league as Donald Trump, and I suspect it's backfiring on him. He's now talking about, well, not only do I agree with a wall, building a wall on the Mexican border, but he's also saying we should look into building a wall on the Canadian border, only 5,525 miles of it. And it just sounds like he's doing a lot of pandering when Donald Trump was talking about children here born in the United States of people here illegally. Donald Trump said they should not be citizens, even though the 14th Amendment guarantees that birthright. And then Scott Walker started saying, well, I don't know if they should be citizens either. I don't know, about the 14th Amendment. Eventually he said, I'm not in favor of changing the amendment, but he did dither on it for several days and it hurt his campaign.
Well, and here is Wisconsin governor and GOP presidential candidate Scott Walker speaking in New Hampshire recently, addressing what he calls a growing anger among voters. He's speaking at the Politics and Eggs event at St. Anselm College earlier in August.
People are angry with Washington. There's just no doubt about it. I see it all across America. Heck, I'm angry with Washington. I'm not just angry at the president and with the Democrats. I'm upset with a lot of the leaders of my own party. Well, it's August. And our party, my party, has controlled both chambers of the United States Congress, and I still don't see a bill on the president's desk to repeal Obamacare.
So that's the theme, Ken, that, hey, Republicans have the House and the Senate, and yet they haven't really done much to combat this president. That seems to be what he's saying.
Well, I know, and Republicans are saying that a lot of time. There's a lot of frustration among Republican grassroots, conservative grassroots, saying, look, we have the Senate with Mitch McConnell, we have the House under John Boehner, and yet we still have Obamacare. The point they're forgetting, of course, is that you're not going to repeal Obamacare when you have a guy named Obama in the White House. So even Mitch McConnell is smart enough to know that. John Boehner will throw the right wing a bone every now and then. Okay, let's have another vote to defund Obamacare. But McConnell says, look, it's a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. You know that if it passes the Senate, it's going to be vetoed by President Obama. There's no way the Senate is going to be able to overturn such a veto. So why waste our time on political theatrics? But, people like Scott Walker says, well, we're frustrated. Washington is letting us down. And the leaders, McConnell and Boehner, are at fault.
Well, and here's an email that came in from Eric in Conway, who says the Republicans, with the help of the media, have managed to make immigration the great distraction in this election cycle. Eric says the real important issues of the climate, economy, and international issues have all taken a back seat. He says immigration is a scapegoat. We always want to blame the other, quote, for our problems. That is much easier than dealing with the real problem. Eric, thank you for the email. Why all the focus on immigration in this campaign? And by the way, Ken, I did want to say I read this morning that the Canadian border wall Scott Walker comment was kind of taken out of context. I just want to put that over there.
So he's not supporting a wall of 5,525 miles.
It seems like, there was sort of some confusion in the interview and so forth. But why the immigration issue? Why is it emerging yet again?
First of all, I think immigration is a crucial question. I don't think the media is making this up. I disagree with some of Eric's email. I mean, there are 11 million people here illegally, and the system is not working, and something needs to be done. But to be honest, I mean, I don't know if it's a media creation, but it's certainly a Donald Trump creation, because when he announced his candidacy, his whole thing was about Mexico and immigrants and the murderers and rapists and some good people that Mexico is sending here over the border. And then suddenly it touched a nerve, whether it's xenophobia or nativism or whatever it is. But there are a lot of people, as you say, scapegoats, scapegoated Mexicans for all our problems. And then other Republican candidates either didn't know how to react. And to their credit, people like Jeb Bush and John Kasich and other so-called moderates say, no, this is ridiculous. This is not the way to deal with immigration problems. There must be a pathway to citizenship, or at least some way of enabling them to stay in the United States if they deserve to do so. But when Donald Trump says round them up and send them home, then you have a Scott Walker, you have a Ted Cruz, you have a Mike Huckabee, you have other Republicans saying not a bad idea. So, again, I mean, the media certainly are reporting what the candidates are saying, but I don't think it's a creation of the media. I think once Donald Trump brought up the argument and looking at his polls, everybody seemed to fall in line, or at least a lot of candidates seemed to fall in line.
Well, Eric, thank you for the email. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at some of the nation's top political stories with political junkie Ken Rudin. And Ken, let's go to Earl in Newfane, Vermont. Hi, Earl. Go ahead. You're in the exchange with Ken Rudin. Earl, go ahead. You're on the radio. Okay. I think Earl needs to turn down his phone when he calls back. Sometimes that messes people up. Let's turn to the Democrats, Ken. And here's an email from Christopher in Manchester. Can Ken address the collective yawn in the mainstream media when Secretary Clinton recently likened GOP candidates to, quote, terrorists? Christopher says, would the same indifference be accorded to Bush, Rubio et al? Christopher, thank you for the email. Ken, I had not heard this quote. Go ahead.
I haven't heard that quote, but I've certainly heard, but that is not unheard of on the Democratic side. I remember when President Obama likened the opponents to the Iranian nuclear deal to people who were allied with the people in Tehran. I mean, that is so over the top and so incendiary that, of course, if Donald Trump said it, people would say, my God, you know, Donald Trump is off his rocker. But there are a lot of quotes from the Democrats who are just, you know, there are a lot of Democrats who feel that the Republicans have gone too far on so many issues, on women's rights, on immigration, things like that, that they'll say things that it just seems to be a little bit over the top. But I think both sides are guilty of it. Maybe the Democrats not as much, but I agree with Christopher in the sense that what the Democrats say is not getting as much attention. But in fairness, there is still a lot of incendiary and over the top and sometimes ugly comments coming from the Republican side on certain issues.
Let's try Earl in Newfane, Vermont again. Hi, Earl. Are you there? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was off the air. My comment is it seems that that establishment candidates like Bush and even Tea Party candidates like Walker can't get any traction in this primary at this point. And the voters in Iowa seem to be more interested in someone who's either more charismatic or totally anti-establishment, or someone who can just get things done in whatever way they have in mind.
Or at least they think it can get, hope
right.
that they
yeah.
can get
and
things done.
This voter seemed to be gravitating towards anyone in that ilk, and it seems that even Bush's latest ad may not even have that much impact on these voters.
Sure, the anti-establishment, anti-Washington sentiment. Earth.
Right.
Yeah, well, thank you for calling in. And Ken, you addressed this earlier, but your thoughts?
Well, I don't know. I mean, certainly, I mean, you can't blame Jeb Bush for the problems in Washington. He's never been to Washington. He was, for two terms, the governor of Florida and a very conservative governor of Florida. But when he was governor of Florida, it seemed like it was a lifetime ago. Certainly in the Republican Party, it was a lifetime ago, because now he's seen as a moderate, as a squish, as some people say. But even more so, there seems to be no joy in watching him campaign. And that's surprising. Look, we know he's a wonk. We know he's very smart. We know he's not one of those glad handlers, those guys who love campaigning the way certainly George W. Bush loved to campaign. Jeb Bush would rather sit and talk policy for 45 minutes. That doesn't get you elected president, let alone win the nomination. But that's who Jeb Bush is. But Jeb Bush just doesn't seem, I mean, with his comments recently on anchor babies, that I'm sure he didn't mean it the way it sounded, but when he tried to dig himself out of the hole, he dug himself deeper by saying, well, I'm really talking about Asians, not Mexicans, when it comes to anchor babies. And he kind of says things that just don't resonate. And so he's not part of the Washington problem, but he's certainly part of the establishment problem. And for many of us, me included, who thought that Jeb Bush would be the likely nominee, I don't see how he comes out of it. The last Iowa poll has him with 6% of the vote. He's tied with Marco Rubio, 6% of the vote with less than 5 months. Actually, it's exactly 5 months to go before Iowa, just over 5 months to go before New Hampshire. It seems like there's enough time, but right now I've not seen anything that shows that he's capable of switching gears.
Well, getting back to Christopher, our earlier email criticizing Hillary Clinton, I did want to ask you about the recent news, Ken, of the Clinton's campaign facing a lot of questions about her use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State. Now, this is a story that's been going on for a long time, but more emails were just released from that private account by the State Department. Help us out with this story, Ken. What did we learn just recently?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the emails were redacted. A lot of it we don't know. But I kind of think that Hillary Clinton is getting a break by us focusing on whether there were national security secrets in her emails. She says, well, if they were national security secrets, they weren't classified when I received them, and they were only classified later. And that seems to be the argument that's going back and forth. The real thing to me, I mean, if you look at the poll, look, yes, she's leading in the polls. Yes, she's the odds-on favorite for the Democratic nomination. If you look at the Iowa poll, 61% of the Democrats, likely caucus voters, say they don't care about this email server controversy. But to me, given the numbers that you see in the polls about questions about her honesty and trustworthiness, which are really, really have been declining for months, and for Hillary Clinton to decide on her own that 31,000 or so emails were personal, and therefore I could delete them and destroy them. Seems to me like unfathomable. It's completely unfair to mention Richard Nixon and Hillary Clinton in the same sentence. And even by doing it just now, I know I'm going to get criticized. But having said that, there were just questions about her honesty and the fact that she doesn't come forward. And then when she makes jokes and says, well, I just signed up for Snapchat, which is great because the messages disappear by themselves. Is that supposed to be funny? If you don't see a Hillary Clinton headline without the letters FBI next to it. And I think, as Ed Rendell, the former Democratic National Committee chairman, he said, he was quoted in the New York Times saying, they've handled this issue poorly, maybe atrociously, certainly horribly. And I agree with that. I think they're not taking it serious. And maybe Democrats don't care. But look, a lot of Republicans don't care about Donald Trump. But there are some people who think that both Trump and Hillary Clinton are saying things or are doing things that they have to think twice about.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you about Bernie Sanders in a minute. But first, so Hillary Clinton's troubles, what does that mean for the possibility of Joe Biden jumping in?
I don't think he does it. I don't think, you know, I don't think if Joe Biden does it, it's not. I mean, there are a lot of, look, I don't know what a lot means. I know the media would love another candidate in the race because we love more candidates. And I would like to see Joe Biden run for that same reason. But what's the rationale for Joe Biden to run other than the fact that, I mean, he's been a very effective vice president, a loyal vice president. He spent 436 years in the Senate, which I think is longer than anybody else in history. No, I mean, look, he has a very long, storied, impressive career. And, you know, while for the longest time he was the crazy Uncle Joe with the back rubs and the gaffes and the weird things he would say, he's now, we see him differently. We're still mourning with his unfathomable loss of his son to go along with the other tragedies in his life. And he's clearly, you know, wrestling with that decision. I don't know what he brings to the race. I mean, he doesn't have Hillary Clinton's money or organization or the sense of history, being the first woman, you know, ever elected president. And if you want an alternative, you have Bernie Sanders, who is running at Hillary Clinton's left. Biden wouldn't run at her left. I don't know what he would
do. Where he would fit.
I don't know what he would say differently, except for the fact that there, you know, people like him, and the questions of likability and trustworthiness, he has it all over Hillary Clinton.
So what about Bernie Sanders? He keeps chugging along, keeps drawing the big crowds, not just in the progressive strongholds like, you know, Seattle and Portland, Oregon, but in the South and Midwest, drew some good crowds here in New Hampshire. What are you hearing, Ken, there, you know, inside the Beltway, the party establishment for Democrats? How are they feeling about this Sanders strength?
Well, you know something? I've been inside the Beltway my entire political career, and I never took that as a bad thing. But now when I heard inside the Beltway, I could see why people like just roll their eyes in disgust about that. Because inside the Beltway, Donald Trump is a demagogue and doesn't make sense. Inside the Beltway, Hillary Clinton is a mess and untrustworthy. And the partisans of both candidates don't see that at all. So I don't know what inside the Beltway means anymore. A lot of us dismiss Bernie Sanders. He's 74. He'll be 74 years old, I think, later this month. No president has ever been elected that old. He's a self-described socialist. Is that what Democrats in the South are going to vote for? But who knows? I mean, I don't dismiss those crowns. I don't dismiss the numbers. He's gained a ton of support in Iowa. And if you talk to people in Iowa, Democrats in Iowa, it's not because they don't like what Hillary Clinton is doing or they don't trust the email service story or things like that. They just like Bernie Sanders. They like what he stands for. The issues about income inequality and trade and climate change and the cost of going to college, things like that. I mean, there are a lot of Democrats who feel that the party has lost its way, and Bernie Sanders is the guy who will bring them back to that point of view.
Let's take another call. This is John in Stratham. Hi, John. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Oh, good morning. Good morning. I was wondering, there has been in the press or in the international press a number of reports of Russian shelling of the Ukraine. And rather than get into the goods and bads of that, I'm wondering, we haven't heard any of the candidates speak in details about what they would do with international policy. And it may just be too early, but I wanted to ask Ken if he really has an estimate of when in the election cycle we might start getting some more serious, detailed answers from our candidates about what they would do in the foreign policy arena.
Sure. Good question, John. Beyond immigration and Iran, which we're going to talk about in a minute, Ken. But yeah, go ahead. Other international issues equally pressing.
Certainly, I have not heard Democrats talk about Putin and what Russia is doing. Not at all. I mean, most of what the Democrats are talking about are besides the lack of Democratic debates, the fact they're talking about more domestic issues. Republicans are saying that, you know, Obama has a naive foreign policy and they'll be tough with Putin. But, you know, when you're asked about troops on the ground or more aid to Ukraine or sending missiles to Ukraine, or things like that, you know, there's a lot of vagueness. So right now, there's no real specifics. Even Donald Trump says, I mean, everything Donald Trump says, you know, I'm just going to do it because they love me and I'm a businessman and they'll listen to me. And even Bill O'Reilly, who had a recent interview with Trump, is just incredulous, saying, because you're a businessman, Donald Trump and the leader of China and North Korea and all that will sit and listen to you. And Trump is convinced of it, but there's no specifics coming out of the Republican Party about foreign policy like that.
All right. Well, John, thank you for the call. And we'll take more of your calls in just a moment. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on the migrant crisis in Europe and the future of open borders within the EU. Then, for this month's Environmental Outlook, improving transportation in U.S. cities. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
That's this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the New Hampshire Highland Games, celebrating Scottish heritage, music, athletics, and more, September 18th, 19th, and 20th at Loon Mountain, nhscot.org. And Skillings & Sons, well drilling, well pump service, water filtration, and geothermal, providing water for over 40 years, skillingsandsons.com. AC hot, humid across New Hampshire today. High temperatures mid-80s to around 90 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight. Areas of fog in the overnight. Lows tonight from upper 50s. Northern parts of the state ranging upper 60s in southern New Hampshire.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our once-a-month check-in with political junkie Ken Rudin. Join us as we cover some of the top political headlines of the nation. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken, we've talked a lot about the presidential primaries, both on the Republican and Democratic side. Let's turn now to events on Capitol Hill and some murmurings, Ken, about a government shutdown this fall. Really?
Well, if you ask Mitch McConnell, you know, that Republican sellout who runs the Senate and says that's the last thing the Republicans want. We'd rather have the voters look at President Obama's failures, his failure in foreign policy, his failure in domestic policy, and rather than inflict any injuries on ourselves. And yet there are people like Ted Cruz who say that the federal funding of Planned Parenthood, the effort of which to defeat those funds the effort to delete those funds, cut those funds, was defeated in the Senate before they went on the summer break. But Cruz and others insist that it'll come back as an issue in the fall. And some are saying, and Ted Cruz is one of them, saying that if the Democrats and the White House insist on funding for Planned Parenthood, we could see shutting down the government. Again, you have a presidential election coming up. The last time they shut down the government, the Republicans lost in the polls. I mean, we're doing really poorly in the polls. It backfired in the polls. But conservatives will tell you, well, if it backfired in the polls so much, how come we won all those seats in 2014?
Right.
So
short political memories or short political impact.
Exactly right. So I think there are some Republicans who feel the risk is worth it to shut down the government on principle. But that's not what the American people seem to be favoring at the moment.
Well, and we'll probably talk more about that the next time we talk, Ken, because there'll be some more activity on that. They're not back from their Labor Day recess yet. So
right.
We'll see what happens there.
We leave the presidential race completely,
I
just wanted to talk about the lack of Democratic debates.
Big issue in New Hampshire. Yeah, go ahead.
It is a big issue in New Hampshire. I mean, if you think of the last time there was a big Democratic contest in 2007, 2008, led by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, but you also had Chris Dodd and Joe Biden and Bill Richardson and John Edwards and all those guys. By the end of October in 2007, you had 8 presidential debates, a bunch of them in New Hampshire. You had, I think, 5 before Labor Day. You had 8 by the end of October. This year, you have 1 in October. You have 1 in the middle of November. And the New Hampshire one is the Saturday before Christmas. And there are some Democrats, Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley among them, who say that this is a rigged system, that they're doing it to protect Hillary Clinton, that in the past the Democrats have had open debates, open and wide-ranging debates, but this time they're not doing it. We're only going to have 3 before Iowa, and they say that's insane.
Wow. So 5 Democratic debates before Labor Day, 2 cycles ago.
Yep. I went through the list on my just last night, and I'm saying I didn't realize it, but there were 5 before Labor Day, starting in April.
Wow!
And by the end of October, there were 8 total, and then you had 4 more by the end of the year, and yet you're only having 3 this year. And O'Malley, I think, is right to say, you know, something is wrong here.
Well, so does it make a difference? I mean, New Hampshire Democrats are upset. We've talked about that on this show many times. Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders are upset. Other Democrats around the country are upset. So does this change?
I don't think it changes, but I think debates make a difference. I mean, if you go back to 2007, I always thought that Hillary Clinton was the clear, not only the clear front runner, but the almost certain Democratic nominee for 2008. And then there was one debate in November of 2007 where Tim Russert asked her a question about driver's license for people here illegally, and she kind of stammered and wavered back and forth, and then the other candidates had the advantage. And then I started thinking, well, maybe there is something to this Barack Obama character, this guy from Illinois who very few people know. So I kind of think that debates are very illuminating about the character, about the personalities. And I think, you know, I mean, yes, Hillary Clinton has this huge lead nationally. And I'm not saying that we should have debates so Hillary Clinton isn't the nominee. But I just think that if there are problems with her candidacy or anybody's candidacy, it should come. Debates should be. We should have these debates to let the Democrats make their cases and then let the voters decide.
Well, let's take another call, Ken. And this is Walker in Hooksett. Hi, Walker. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just this ties in a little bit with what Ken just said, but I'm wondering why Martin O'Malley isn't getting more traction, more attention from the press. He certainly comes across to me as presidential. And he's to Hillary's left, and he seems like a good alternative to Hillary. And also, because he has executive experience. So
sure, Governor Maryland. Walker, have you seen him around New Hampshire? Have you gone to any
of
his events?
I met him at least once.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for calling in, Walker. Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, I agree with Walker. I'm surprised as well. I thought he would be doing better. I think the last poll, again, here we go, polls again, but the Iowa poll had him at 2 or 3%. Yes, he was mayor of Baltimore. Yes, he was governor of Maryland for two terms. He did have good support. He has been hurt by his reputation for having very strong anti-demonstrator, pro-police tactics while mayor of Baltimore to keep crime down, similar to what Bill Clinton signed as president, that anti-crime law that talked more about incarceration than anything else. He's taking the heat from it, especially when we saw the riots in Baltimore. People go back and say, well, it started with Martin O'Malley, who favored the police over the residents. So he was hurt by that, but it seems like we don't have enough attention span to cover more than two candidates on the Democratic side. The Bernie Sanders story is exciting. It's unusual. It's unexpected. And we're still going with it. But I would think that other candidates like Martin O'Malley should have a shot.
If there are more debates, people might get a chance to these candidates.
And look at the poll in Iowa with Joe Biden with 14%. And he's probably not going to even run. So it's pretty sad. I mean, it's disappointing if you're Martin O'Malley, you're saying this is not the way I expected it to work out.
All right. Well, we'll be talking more about some of these issues tomorrow, by the way, when we look specifically at 100 years of the New Hampshire primary and how the parties have tried to manipulate the way these things unfold.
By the way, tomorrow, though, is the official, they're changing the name of the exchange to Denali. They're changing the name of the show, so it's official.
Okay, so that's my segue. So let's talk about that. So President Obama goes to Alaska to talk about climate change and, you know, all that ice melting in Alaska. But he also changed the name of Mount McKinley, named after slain former President McKinley from Ohio. He changes the name of Mount McKinley back to the Native American name, Denali. People in Alaska love it. People in Ohio, not so much.
Well, I never realized that William McKinley was the most popular. I think as of yesterday or 2 days ago, William McKinley was the greatest Republican president in the history of the Republican Party. But first of all, I was in Alaska last summer doing actually a political junkie show with Neil Conan, and everybody called it Denali. I mean, that's
really?
Basically
okay.
Yeah, everybody called it Denali, and Denali National Park. And Lisa Murkowski, a Republican, praised President Obama. Said, "Look, the Alaska tribes, thank you. This is what we've always called it." They named it actually. If you know the whole story, there was somebody who was when William McKinley was nominated for president in 1896. Somebody said, "This is a great. I love this McKinley guy. We should name the mountain after him." Now, Congress didn't go get around to doing until 1917, when McKinley was already a former president and an assassinated president.
Right.
But he was named when he was just the nominee for president, which is kind of funny. And Republicans now, and some Democrats in Ohio, are outraged. How do you do this? How do you make this executive decision on your own? It was an act of Congress that called it Mount McKinley in 1917. How does Sally Jewell, the Secretary of Interior, and President Obama just on their own say it's now Denali by the, you know, by snap of the fingers? So
I was wondering that, too. I mean, where the, I mean, not that it matters to me what the name of the mountain is, but I do wonder about who's got the power to go around renaming mountains.
Well, apparently the president does. And the argument, Sally Jewell said, look, you know, look, William McKinley has nothing to do with the mountain. He's never been to Alaska. But look, George Washington never was in a car on the bridge from New York to New Jersey. And yet nobody's complaining about that. But anyway, but somebody, it would be interesting to ask Hillary Clinton what she thinks about it, because nobody wants to alienate voters in Ohio. And at least for now, Democrats and Republicans are not happy about the change, you know, because William McKinley, he was a very effective president, his campaign was very consequential about the future of economics in this country, the battle between gold and silver, his famous campaigns against William Jennings Bryan. But, I mean, for the most part, I think people are rolling their eyes, but they're not rolling their eyes in Ohio.
All right. Well, about something a little bit, well, I don't want to say more serious, but definitely more serious than this debate over Denali and McKinley. The White House, Ken, counting noses in the U.S. Senate for its Iran nuclear deal. Now, you're going to have to step back for me, please. A little civics lesson, because there's been some confusion. I thought that the president only needed to go to the U.S. Senate for this, because it's
right. If it was a treaty,
it's a treaty. Okay, it's,
but it's not
a treaty. Okay,
no,
go
it's
ahead.
Not a treaty. It's a nuclear. It's an agreement to limit Iranian's nuclear program. So it's not a treaty. Therefore, it's a regular issue that Congress could vote no on. The president can veto it, and then both houses, to overturn the president's veto, have to come up with a two-thirds majority to overturn the veto. It's unlikely that the opponents could do it in the House. There's no way that they can get two-thirds to overturn it. Most attention is on the Senate. Right now, they need 34 Democrats. They need 34 senators to vote to sustain President Obama's veto. And right now there are 31 Democrats who are on board. It's most likely that while the Senate will vote down the treaty, President Obama will veto it, but the Senate will not be able to overturn the veto because more than 34 senators will back the president.
Well, and it's been tough for some members of Congress to decide which way to go on this. Here's a little piece of sound from New York Democratic Congressman Jerry Nadler telling WNYC after some long thought, he is deciding to support the deal. Let's hear.
This deal is far from perfect, to put it mildly. There are a lot of problems with the deal. The question is, could you get a better deal if you went back to the negotiating table? Or more to the point, could you force Iran back to the negotiating table and get a better deal? My conclusion was you could not.
Again, that's Jerry Nadler, Democratic congressman from New York, talking on WNYC. The politics of this Iran deal, Ken, then, not quite so clear that, you know, Democrats will support the president and Republicans won't.
Well, it's also has a lot to do with the politics of Israel. And Jerry Nadler, being a Jewish Democrat from New York, the fact that he supports the treaty is kind of interesting, because there are a lot of, I don't know what a lot means, but there are several Jewish members of Congress, notably Senator Chuck Schumer, but Congressman Elliot Engel, who's the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee. There are a lot of Jews who feel that this is just bad for Israel. They're almost taking the Netanyahu line that this is just bad for Israel. Others are saying, as Nadler just said, this is far from a perfect deal. Yes, there are no inspections. Yes, there are no guarantees. But look, as soon, you know, even if we voted this treaty down, the rest of our allies, Germany, Britain, everybody else, will drop the sanctions anyway. So we'll be very lonely in our opposition, and it wouldn't be good for our foreign policy. So it's not a done deal. Even if the deal goes through, which is likely, I think it remains unpopular with the American people. The question, as Nadler says, is what's the alternative? And there may not be an alternative.
Well, and here's an email that just came in from Kate in Keene. She says, I used to live in Alaska when I was a kid. We called it Denali Mount McKinley. Kate says, my daughter-in-law now lives in Fairbanks, Alaska. She says, everybody calls it Denali and have for quite some time. Nothing new there, Kate says. So, Kate, but, thank you for the email.
But, you know, there's no place like Nome.
You know, I did want to ask you also about President Obama going to the Gulf Coast, going to Louisiana. Hard to believe, Ken, 10 years since Hurricane Katrina, and a lot of politicians went down there over the past week or so. What were they trying to do or say?
Well, including George W. Bush. And that, and you know, when you think of the beginning of the end for the Republicans in 2006 and 2008, yes, there were higher food prices. Yes, there was an unpopular war in Iraq. But I kind of think that the beginning of the end for the Bush administration and the Republican reign of, you know, after the 2004 election came with the president's less than effective response to Katrina. You know, the famous picture of him looking at New Orleans from Air Force One, not touching down until much, much later when it was almost too late. I think there were so many people at fault, Governor Blanco, Mayor Nagin, and those Democrats. But the president, the fact that the president of the United States looked at New Orleans from afar, I think was a sign that sent a signal to a lot of people that maybe this is not the compassionate conservative we used to talk about. So that was the beginning of the end. Anyway, 10 years later, if you've been to New Orleans lately, there's a lot that's been done that looks that has been really effective and great accomplishments. But there's so much to be done. And I mean, when President Obama went down there, he said that I think he almost kind of took credit, but that the people are resilient and things are getting done. But there were so many problems with New Orleans prior to Katrina, as far as poverty, as far as joblessness, as far as dilapidated homes, and that still continues in much of the city.
Well, Bobby Jindal, running for president on the Republican side, governor of Louisiana, he was not governor during Katrina, but how has he been talking about this, Ken?
You know something, it's a question I did not anticipate, and I'll tell you why. Bobby Jindal, from the moment he was elected governor, which was after Kathleen Blanco decided not to run because of Katrina, he was seen as a rising star in the Republican Party. He had the first Republican response to President Obama's address to a joint session of Congress. But right now, the numbers, his popularity at home has really sunk to really record lows. The deficit, the budget is out of whack. Of course, he won't raise taxes because he campaigned on that promise. But right now, so much is not getting done. He's battling with his fellow Republicans in the legislature. So I don't really know what he said about Katrina, but I just know that Bobby Jindal is just not making traction in his bid for the presidency.
Okay. Well, Ken Rudin, good to talk to you. Maybe next time, next month when you join us, we can talk about Kanye West deciding to run in 2020.
No, you know, Don Gagne married Kanye West. Oh, we could talk about that later.
All right. We'll talk about it next month. Ken Rudin, always good to talk to you. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Laura.
That's political junkie Ken Rudin. He joins us once a month here on The Exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, a century of first in the nation. The New Hampshire presidential primary celebrates its 100th birthday next year, and a new book chronicles those many decades. There's lots of primary lore, the travails and triumphs of candidates here, but the book also examines criticism of our state's large role in the nomination process and whether that should change. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Show next at 10 o'clock on NHPR, where support comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Mount Washington Cog Railway's Summit Photo Tour, with a chance to take photos on a round-trip train to Mount Washington led by a professional photographer, September 13th, thecog.com. Hazy, hot, humid today. High temperatures from mid-80s to around 90 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight. Areas of fog in the overnight. Lows tonight, upper 50s. Northern New Hampshire ranging upper 60s in southern parts of the state.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Tamara Keith, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Hungary has become the latest flashpoint in Europe's escalating migrant crisis. Police in Budapest set off angry protests yesterday when they barred hundreds of migrants from getting on trains bound for Western Europe. Neighboring Austria disrupted vehicle traffic from Hungary, saying it was part of efforts to crack down on smugglers. In Germany, Chancellor Merkel called on all EU nations to take in their fair share of migrants. Europe is experiencing the biggest movement of people since World War II, as hundreds of thousands flee war and poverty in the Middle East and North Africa. An update on migrants and refugees in Europe, but first the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A manhunt continues in northern Illinois. Authorities are searching for three people wanted in the fatal shooting of a police officer. Sean Kennedy of member station WBEZ reports.
About 100 officers from several agencies scoured the area overnight, assisted by helicopters. The hunt continues today for three men suspected of shooting Lieutenant Charles Joseph Glenowitz yesterday morning. U.S. Congressman Bob Dolt represents Fox Lake, about 50 miles north of Chicago.
There has been federal assets on the ground, as well as from the sheriff's office and multiple police departments. So there is an all-out effort. People should feel good about that, but we still want them to remain aware, alert.
Glenowitz told dispatchers he was chasing three men on foot in the village. When backup arrived, they found Glenowitz shot dead and stripped of his gun and pepper spray. For NPR News, I'm Sean Kennedy in Chicago.
Demonstrators have gathered outside a courthouse in Baltimore, Maryland. A hearing is underway today in the case of six Baltimore police officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray last April. Gray died after he was arrested. His death triggered days of peaceful protests in Baltimore and then riots. While President Obama has been in Alaska for the last 2 days, today will be his first trip to the actual Arctic. He'll travel just north of the Arctic Circle to the coastal town of Kotzebue. Elizabeth Arnold has more.
About 3,000 people live in Kotzebue, mainly Inupiaq Eskimos. Although the president will only make a short trip from the airport to the school, he'll see plenty from the air. This part of Alaska is not connected by roads, and many residents live a subsistence life of hunting and fishing, which has been impacted by thinning ice, melting permafrost, sea level rise, and storms. It's the last stop on the president's trip in Alaska, and where he intends to put a human face on what he says is an urgent need to act swiftly to address climate change. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Anchorage.
Several high-speed Eurostar trains traveling from Paris to London were forced to turn back after migrants entered the Channel Tunnel. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports one train was stuck for hours while police tried to remove hundreds of migrants from the tunnel.
French media is reporting that five trains reaching the tunnel on the French side were able to turn back. For a sixth train already inside the tunnel, it was too late. Officials cut the train's electricity so migrants jumping on the roof would not be electrocuted.